Hey everyone, Dalton Hopkins of FrontStretch.com here. First off, I want to thank you for taking a listen to part two of this FrontStretch exclusive podcast, Rebranding Brandon Brown. Last time, Brandon and I spoke about his childhood, how his love of racing came to fruition, and his early struggles in the world of motorsports marketing. If you haven't taken a listen to that yet, I highly recommend you listen to episode one first. But now, we enter part two, where we cover his entrance into NASCAR competition in the truck series, how it became an Xfinity Series ride, his father's cancer diagnosis, and his successful 2020 season, complete with a bid in the playoffs. And of course, his struggles and triumphs as a team owner all along the way. So, sit back, relax, and enjoy part two of this FrontStretch exclusive podcast, Rebranding Brandon Brown. FrontStretch.com, and welcome to part two of Rebranding Brandon Brown. Brandon, thank you for being here and joining me today. This one, we're going to talk about a little more you entering NASCAR, a little bit more after your whole Little League days, if you really want to call it that, your Little League days, late models. Now we're getting into the big leagues. Tell me about what made you decide to enter such a competitive and cutthroat world, in both competitively and in marketing world of NASCAR.
Yeah, it definitely is cutthroat when it comes to on the marketing side. The competition side is pretty hard, but the marketing side is definitely harder. So it was just a dream of ours to make it to NASCAR and to race professionally in stock cars. And well, there's really no other place you can go do that other than NASCAR. So that was our landing pad, and that's where we wanted to be. So we entered the truck series, made our debut in Iowa. And that was probably one of the roughest races of my career. I feel like everything that happened in that race that could go wrong went wrong. And we didn't really know what to expect when it came to running that long of a race, because like you said, everything we'd done before was late model stock cars. So you had 75 lap features or 120 lap features, not, you know, upwards of 250 laps.
Yeah. And then your first race at Iowa, and I told you before, they didn't even mention you. I mean, I rewatched the race, and from what I remember, they didn't mention you at all, not even on the lineup. They were going through, you know, all the rows, and they stopped right before they got to your row. They didn't even mention your name. So yeah, it just kind of really goes to show how difficult it is to really get your name out, even when you're in that competitive world of NASCAR. So that being said, how difficult was it for you to get your name out there in those first couple of years?
I mean, yeah, it was incredibly difficult. It's just something where I don't know if it's because we didn't do the right steps, according to NASCAR, where, you know, most people, their step is go-kart, Bandolero, Legends car, late model stock car, K&N Pro Series trucks. Cause we skipped from go-kart to late model truck. And, I don't know if we just didn't do the correct steps or what, but yeah, they were very focused on talking about anybody and everybody else that was on the track. And, you know, looking back, it was a bummer because, you know, we were so excited. It was our first race, and I was like ready to see myself or the truck on TV like we had always dreamed of. And it just wasn't there. So it was kind of a bummer, but it's probably a good thing they didn't show us, because our truck, I mean, it was an old Eddie Sharp racing truck. We were pretty far off the pace just because we didn't have much of an idea on what it took to set them up. You know, it was very different from the late model that we had been running, and just had some radio issues. Unfortunately, we had a lot of pit crew issues, but that's because I guess my family didn't really understand how intense a pit crew is and what it takes to be a tire changer, a gas man, or jack man. Cause they thought, you know, we could piece it together with our own crew. our own family members, like Dad and David Clark, who still works with us, tried going over the wall. And, you know, Adam was our crew chief, but it was kind of wild when we hit pit road. It looked like the Bad News Bears. We had the slowest pit stops you'd ever seen. I mean, I thought we were going to go a lap down under caution. So not great on the pit stop sides. And yeah, we just, you know, unsponsored first time truck. And, you know, I mean, we just, I guess, didn't do the right things to get our names out there. But no, in those first few years, you just sit there and the best thing that we have is social media. It's extremely helpful and extremely hurtful, but in this instance, it was helpful on, you know, announcing that we were going to be at the tracks and really trying to make a big deal of it. But, you know, we were making very one-off starts in the truck series. We were every couple months, basically, we would show up to the track.
If I'm not mistaken, I think it was three starts in 2014. So yeah, every so often you get on track, but then in 2015, you make some more starts. Sometimes you qualify, sometimes you don't, but that's, if I'm not mistaken, that's also when Coastal Carolina University came on board. You mentioned them the last time on the last episode, but tell me again how that sponsorship came to be and how that relationship grew as time progressed, because they stayed with you for a few years.
Yeah, no. So that was, I had just became a student at Coastal Carolina University when that sponsorship happened. We were going to make extremely limited truck series starts, just kind of trying to get licensed up, do the whole jumping through the hoops to get licensed for intermediate tracks and super speedways and everything else that you need to do. So we planned on, you know, I was in college full time, so we couldn't run a full season and have me doing school at the same time. So we decided we were going to, I think that was like a 6 to 8 race season. And we wanted to get everything set so that in the event that we went full time, we could still run for rookie of the year. So during that year, we were at Atlanta Motor Speedway, and I had, you know, again, just started at Coastal. So I had everybody that gets to their college for the first year is excited, and they wear their college gear, you know, whether it's a polo or a hat or whatever. And I had the Coastal Carolina University hat on, and I took a picture with the truck, and we were in the pits, and just posted that I was excited for the race. And I think I hashtagged at CCU and Sean's up, and somebody at the school gave it to the comms VP, Bill Plate. And he, when I got back to Coastal after that race, he had ended up calling me and bringing me into his office and was like, "Hey, what's this?" Turns out Bill was a NASCAR fan, and he was just like, "This is awesome. Like, how do we get Coastal more involved?" And then that's when I freaked out, because I was like, okay, like, you know, I put on my best sales act, and but, you know, I pitched them everything I could to sponsor our truck.
Just a lot of pieces falling into place there. But I mean, what joy, I mean, that you must have felt at that moment that somebody was finally interested in your NASCAR endeavors. And then your relationship grew throughout 2015. But again, you said you were already a student. Can you tell me a little bit, like, again, you have that degree in communication, and that probably includes some marketing. I would know, I have the same degree, but you also, we took those classes and you were learning these new lessons. Were you in those classes thinking, "Oh, I can apply this to my race team," or, "Oh, I can apply this to racing in general"? Was there kind of that connection being made in the classroom as well?
Yeah. So where it helped a lot was when I was taking these classes and I was learning kind of how media worked and how kind of the social media aspect worked. It's something that you take and you like. For me, I was able to take things that I was learning in the classroom, apply them into a real life scenario. And, you know, obviously it didn't exactly correlate like 100%. As we all know, in the real world, things work way different than just the definitions from a textbook. So I was able to kind of, you know, take things and twist them up and make it apply to my real world job, which was in NASCAR. And we were able to start using things that we had learned to kind of up our presence in social media and up our presence just with media members and create those relationships. And, you know, it made it way easier to talk to people because these are professionals, these that you're dealing with in NASCAR. Everybody that's doing this is, you know, especially when you first get into NASCAR, you're looking at everybody like, oh my God, they are like, they have to be like the professional speaker. So it can be intimidating to go talk to them. And again, with a small family team, you don't have a publicist. You don't have somebody in charge of PR. You don't have somebody that's guiding you. So basically I was leaning on a lot of professors and a lot of the things I learned to kind of guide me.
Was there anything in the classroom, was there any specific lesson that you kind of learned that you think was probably the biggest lesson that you applied to your racing team?
I mean, yeah, there's a few. I remember one of the things that really, really applied just to our race team as a whole, not just me, was actually my senior year. I was doing a communication audit on our race team for my capstone project. And because of that, I was able to kind of learn where a lot of our communication efforts were kind of getting skewed between everybody from, you know, everybody that's sweeping the shop all the way up to the ownership roles with my dad. And that kind of applied, and we were able to really actually start shaping our team a little better and, you know, becoming a little more uniform and a lot more presentable at tracks because our communication effort was there. And I know everybody jokes about a communication degree, but that's the most important piece of business. I mean, I don't care what product you have to sell or what service you have. If you don't have communication, you don't have a business. So it's, you know, it was really important to apply to our team.
I'm a little inclined to agree on the communication side of things. Such an applicable piece of business that you really need literally in anything. So, but yeah, I definitely agree. Of course, I might be a little bit biased. So let's go into 2016 now, into the truck series. Still, you earned your first top five, your first and only top five in the truck series at Daytona that year. Do you remember that at all? And can you tell me a little bit more about what that feeling meant as you got out of the truck?
Yeah. So that was a cool race for us because it was my first sponsored race that wasn't Coastal. It was a company that they no longer exist called Encase It, which built the casings you have with your cars there. They built sports display cases. And so they had sponsored our Daytona truck, and I was excited because I had Encase It, I had Coastal. I was, you know, we were doing some media stuff beforehand. Dick Vitale, Dickie V, he gave us a shout out on social media, which was really cool. But when we were actually at that race, we had myself, and then I brought friends from Coastal, Colin Fern, who still works for our team, and then my other friend, Dalen, who actually now owns Bar Visuals. He's a photographer at the NASCAR tracks, working for Cup teams now, like Team Trackhouse and stuff like that. So it's awesome that a couple of Coastal grads started there, and now look at us trying to make it in this big industry. But no, we were there, and we were just kind of like, okay, we just need to figure out how to avoid the big one. Just that's all we have to do is avoid the big one. And I remember in that race that I was just latched onto Crafton's bumper. And I was like, well, this guy is a serious champion. You know, he knows what he's doing. I'm just going to latch on here. And wherever he goes, we go. And I just remember pushing him the entire race all the way up until like the last lap. I think it was Christopher Bell went over, like flipped over in that race, and felt bad for him. But we ended up crossing the line with a top five. And I just remember Coastal being extremely happy because we beat William Byron, who was in the Liberty University Tundra.
And then another thing that happened in 2016 was your first start, your entrance into the NASCAR Xfinity Series at Richmond. Tell me about how that decision came to be. What made you feel like it was time to move up into the next series?
So it was a little less of a skill-based decision. It was more of a office business standpoint decision, because at the time, the truck series wasn't running Ilmor engines. They were, you had the choice of running an SB2 or an RO7, which is, you know, you're basically getting the same built motors that you would get in the Xfinity series. And the truck series just at the time didn't have as much, their TV ratings weren't very good. And the cost of running a truck compared to the purse, the cost of running a truck, it was comparable to running a NASCAR Xfinity Series car, but the purse payout was way higher in the Xfinity Series. Obviously the competition was way stiffer, but the purse was way higher in the Xfinity Series. So we decided, you know what, let's go ahead and, you know, let's make the transition. And we did, and we got our first car from GMS, they actually brought us out to Richmond, and they helped us with our first race with it. And it was wild, because to me, we jumped in the car and it had felt the same as like how some of my trucks had felt, where it's like, okay, we're a little free. We're not overly great. We have a lot of stuff we can work on, but how are we? And they're like, okay, yeah, understand you're P9 right now. And I was like, I had never been in the top 10. Like just off of practice speed. So I was like, oh wow, this is crazy. Like these guys had the same problems as us, just way faster. But yeah, we got to make our first Xfinity Series start in Richmond, and that one had Coastal on board, and Clark Electric, and Mid-Atlantic Wrecker Service. So it was a fun weekend.
And then we're going to fast forward a little bit after that first Xfinity start at Richmond. We're going to fast forward a little bit to 2020. I know it's a big jump, but that was a really big year for you and for the sport as a whole, because you got a top 10 at Daytona in the Xfinity Series. But then, of course, the big one happened. And I'm not talking about a crash. Of course, COVID-19 occurred. There was a huge break in NASCAR. And then we came back in Darlington. How hard was that for you, as somebody who's constantly looking for sponsorship, who's constantly looking for a more partnership opportunities as a small race team in NASCAR?
Yeah, I mean, it was incredibly hard because we didn't have much partnership to kind of sail us through the the time of COVID and the break that it caused. So, sorry, going through that break from COVID, there was no income for the team. There was a little bit of government stimulus, but all the team got laid off, and we were all kind of working odd and end jobs during that time. Like I went and worked as a property manager, making sure basically the parking lot was clean, and I was collecting rent checks. And it was a good reminder of, I don't want to go work in the real world. I like to work in NASCAR. So when we finally got to go back racing, it was weird because there was no fans at the tracks. There was very limited personnel inside the tracks. So all of your marketing efforts changed from interacting with fans and giving them products and doing coupons and giveaways and everything like that. It all changed to social media driven and TV time. And so it was like taking everything that was already limited and cutting it down even more. And then trying to expect us to go out and land a bunch of big sponsors to keep us operational. So it was extremely difficult. We were able to keep in some good partnerships, like with Larry's Lemonade and a couple of bigger ones that kept us going. So working with them and trying to make connections through them was the key to it all. So, but it was, I just remember it was extremely difficult.
And then when the sport came back in Darlington, you finished 13th, and then Charlotte and Bristol happened 8th and 7th. We're getting top 10s all of a sudden at tracks that aren't, you know, usually wild card races. They're tracks that are like actually difficult to drive. Yes. And suddenly the team starts to see success. How much did that propel you? Because 2020 just was suddenly becoming a good year for you, despite the fact that the world was, you know, suffering a pandemic and the world just seemed to stop turning.
Yeah. I think what came to help us was that NASCAR had taken away our practice time and our qualifying, because now teams were solely reliant on whatever they unloaded with. And then for drivers to kind of communicate back during a race to make in-race adjustments to make their cars better. So our team wouldn't struggle as much. We wouldn't really show up to the tracks with a bunch of different setups in mind, because we didn't have the equipment to change it all out, like having a bunch of different shock and spring packages and different uppers and lowers to put on and a bunch of different sway bars, track, like whatever it was needed to do to adjust your setup at the track. We kind of showed up with one and tweaked on it. So it was already in our game plan of what we usually do. So with every team having to do that, I think it really played an advantage to us, because it was just the way of racing that we were used to.
And tell me a little bit more about those sponsors that were on board with you going into the year, but then how you mentioned Larry's Lemonade, but tell me a little bit more about how some of those sponsors stayed on board with you and the new relationships that came to be throughout that year.
Yeah. So we had like Larry's Lemonade and Jabs Construction and just Mid-Atlantic Record Service, many others. Just we were solely focused on trying to really knock it out of the park with everybody that we had. And I think because of that and our efforts, we were able to start kind of navigating to land some others. And it makes it really easy when you're running in that top 10, because then now the TV's covering you. Now they're talking about you. Now it's not weird to see the 68 on TV. It's not just because we're at a super speedway race. So with that extra TV coverage and everything that we were getting, it made it a lot easier to try and sell us, especially when we started looking towards running into the playoffs.
And talking about TV coverage, you think it was great when you're running in the top 10. Now you're in the playoffs, and now you're taking photos with all the other big time Xfinity drivers who are winning races. Now you're a part of that crew.
Yeah.
What, you hadn't earned your first win yet, but this was suddenly becoming so much more real for you, so much for real for your race team, despite the fact that COVID really hurt you. You still came out of the woodwork and you still seem to not only survive, but then thrive. What was that year? At the end of the year, you made the playoffs. What did that mean for you as a whole and as a person? Did you feel like that you had just, you started to meet your goals?
Yeah. So the playoffs wasn't really in the goal book there. We were just more focused on getting through the year and trying to survive. But when we started going out and exceeding expectations, then, it's a big momentum piece. You have so much confidence walking into the track that, and you're carrying the good momentum of some really good races and some really great finishes that, you know, you almost feel unstoppable. So then when you're running, you know, and you're running that strong, it becomes more of an expectation in the garage and the expectation you give yourself. So when you're racing really hard around these competitors, they're used to racing around you. It's not, you know, again, it's not uncommon for the 68 to be there to where other drivers are kind of just trying to shuffle you out or make some crazy dive bomb moves to put you three wide because they race you with a different level of respect than they normally would have. So when we were in the running for the playoffs, it made it the goal of winning a race. It made it feel a lot more attainable. I don't know if it necessarily was. If you went back and looked on the data sheets and what we had, it didn't really change anything, but we, you know, it just gave you that feeling of it was much more of an attainable goal.
And then as if COVID wasn't bad enough, in April, your dad gets diagnosed with a form of cancer. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed like that seemed to be now a lot of the focus on that put more media focus on you because now this was becoming a much more of a personal story for so many. But what did that mean to you as a race car driver who is now trying to survive through this brutal world of motorsports?
Yeah. I mean, it was as if we didn't have enough on our plate and the world decided you needed one more. No, it was just something that it changed for me a lot because I was so used to always having my father at the track with me and, you know, he's always there to kind of coach, I guess, as much as a dad can. But no, it took all that away. And we, you know, it was kind of like a piece of extra motivation, but at the same time, it was really hard because not that I was alone. I obviously had my team members there and all the employees of BMS, but you know, it was that feeling of being really alone when you're at a racetrack and that, you know, again, I wasn't exactly a prominent figure in the garage. So because we were still Virginia based and we just didn't have that many real friends within the garage, a couple people we'd say hi to, but nothing great. So it was truly like a lonely time, but it was a time of really focusing in on ourselves and what we're doing. And I think it helped us kind of focus in on what needed to be done. So it was that extra piece of motivation to do great.
And at the end of the year in 2020, of course you finished in the playoffs, finished 11th in the standings. Your father at this point has been announced as cancer free. Mm-hmm. So this, what started as just what was going to be a terrible year turned into a huge positive. Tell me about that momentum that you must have been riding on at the end of that year heading into 2021.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was huge because it felt again, like we were unstoppable. Like we were going to go out and win some races and we were going to, you know, we were going to accomplish everything we set out to accomplish. And, you know, it's just, it puts a lot of wind in your sails and moves you in the right direction. You know, it helps you make better decisions because when you're really down in the dumps, sometimes you can tend to make really bad decisions, or when you're, you know, really upset, you make really bad decisions. But when things are going right and you have that momentum built behind you, you can really buckle down and do what you need to do to find success. And that's what we were able to do. And at the end of the season, I mean, I was riding high, like we were going to go sell the entire 2021 race season, like just the one big sponsor. I mean, it didn't happen, obviously, but we, you know, it felt like anything was possible.
And in the 2021, you have some big sponsors coming your way. There's, of course, a lot of events that occur then, but that year, if 2020 was big, yeah, 2021 was probably bigger for you, but I think it's so big, we're going to save that for part three. Yeah. So with that being said, Brandon, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me about all of this, about this whole huge span of entering the world of NASCAR. And I can't wait to talk to you about the next year of 2021.
Absolutely.
All right. Brandon, thank you so much, and you have a good one.
Thanks, you too.
That was part two of our FunStretch exclusive podcast, Rebranding Brandon Brown. Be on the lookout for our next episode when Brandon and I discuss the 2021 season, which not only is his best season statistically, but one that ended with him mired in the center of a political controversy. Until then, I'm Dalton Hopkins with FunStretch.com, and thanks for listening.